I had been an employee with the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office and had left only recently before that because there had been a change in prosecutors. And Jack Warren, I think, had always appreciated my talents as a young lawyer, as little as they may have been at that time. And I understand that he had offered this case to a number of other lawyers. It was going to be a court-appointed case because, of course, she was indigent and had no money to hire a lawyer. And he asked a number of lawyers who refused to represent her because of the facts of the case. I have a feeling that they felt that it was pretty much indefensible as far as having a successful conclusion. So Jack Warren called me up. He didn't tell me that a lot of lawyers had rejected it, but he basically said, "I would like to have you do me a favor." And I appreciated that. So he asked me if I would represent this woman, gave me some very rudimentary facts because he really didn't know them. And I accepted the case, and that was the beginning.
Never considered turning it down like the others had.
No, I don't think I ever considered it. And it was probably for a couple of reasons. First of all, I was not out of the prosecutor's office for very long. And although I had tried serious cases from the prosecutor's side, I had really never had an opportunity to yet defend a really serious case. And the second reason was is I was just kind of a feisty person, always have been, and was just looking for a challenge.
If other lawyers had considered the case to be indefensible in terms of winning, did you think that at first?
I don't know that I ever thought of it that way. I don't even know that I approached it, and that may have been the result of. I don't think it was inexperience because I'd had a number of years of experience in the prosecutor's office, but I never really approached the case as being defensible or not defensible. I was just fascinated by the facts, and I was looking forward to the challenge. And my first thought about the case was to get to the jail and talk to this woman before I even thought about what kind of defense could apply and whether it would be successful.
You decided to pursue a defense of innocent by reason of temporary insanity. Can you explain that decision to me and how that worked?
How to put it, that was a somewhat insincere defense, in the sense that I did not really consider that to be a legitimate offense, defense. I considered it in the final analysis as being the only one that I thought would be successful. Michigan at the time, let's just talk about then, I believe it's the same now, has an insanity defense, but there are very specific requirements before that defense can apply. And there is also, of course, a defense of self-defense, but again, a defense that has very specific requirements before you can even raise it in court. So, given the facts in this case, which in a very rudimentary sense are this, as it relates to those defenses that Francine Hughes poured Coleman fuel all around her ex-husband's bed while he was sleeping in a drunken stupor. I mean, he was not representing any physical threat to her at the time. I certainly did not think that the classical self-defense defense would apply. And the case had gained a lot of notoriety nationally because, for one reason or another, the National Organization of Women had decided that this was going to be the case, the landmark case, in which they were going to raise a unique defense of self-defense in a domestic abuse situation. And they were, I would say, ever present during the time before this case was actually tried. And they had a lot of meetings here. They put a lot of pressure on me. They met with me many times. And ultimately, they were very dissatisfied and unhappy that I did not present this case as a classic self-defense case. In other words, defending yourself with deadly force, if deadly force is applied against you, but the deadly force, of course, not being an immediate application of deadly force, but deadly force as perceived by the abused woman who takes the opportunity to kill her abuser in a situation where she really believes she's defending herself because it's the only opportunity she has to do so successfully.
Is while he's unconscious.
Well, in this case, yes. While he was unconscious, I just never felt that that defense would work. And so there were other defenses available. I mean, insanity for one, but insanity really didn't work in this case because I had a lot of experts who were telling me, no, she was not insane, but that she could have been in a state of mind where she could not comport her actions according to the law. So to make a long story short, because I could go on and on about this, apparently there are some other states that at that time had a defense of temporary insanity. Michigan did not. But I just said, look, to my client, I said, we're going to present your defense as being a situation where you were overwhelmed by your experience with this man. You were in an emotional state where you could not comply with the requirements of the law. And with your permission, I'm going to make it clear to the jury that we're only using this as a handle. We're only using this as a vehicle to allow them to bring back a not guilty verdict. I don't know whether it'll be successful. I don't know whether the judge will let me do this. I don't know whether the prosecutor will raise vigorous arguments against it that will be successful, but we're going to try. And I think that basically what happened was we had a very cooperative judge, Ray C. Hotchkiss, and he allowed me to do that. And when I made my closing arguments to the jury, I basically said that, look, this is not really a legitimate defense. Here's what I would have had to do if I were to argue to you that she was defending herself. I mean, I would love to tell you that and have you believe it, but I don't think that that really would work. So here's what we're going to do. She was temporarily insane. We've got some experts that have told you what that means, and we'd like to have you find her not guilty. And it worked.
We're talking with Arjan Gredanas. He was the defense attorney representing Francine Hughes in the famous Burning Bed case 40 years ago. Having worked previously as a prosecutor and then defended this case, it would be interesting to hear your observations about how domestic abuse cases were handled 40 years ago and compare that to how you might observe cases of domestic abuse are handled today.
Well, 40 years ago, there really was no comprehensive approach to domestic abuse. And in preparing for the Francine Hughes case, I did a lot of reading. There were a few cases, with a defendant named Inez Garcia, for instance, where their attorneys had actually argued self-defense. So there were the beginnings of that kind of an argument for this situation. It was not successful in her case. And there's another case as well that was somewhat famous. And again, I don't remember her name, but the defense was not successful. So that's really part of what caused me not to go that way. But there were the beginnings of a movement, like I said, by the National Organization of Women and other groups to try to address domestic abuse in a structural way rather than just by a case-by-case basis. But nothing was really happening as far as I could tell. When I was in the prosecutor's office, I do remember that there were several assistant prosecutors, and they were women, who did deal with cases that had that domestic abuse element in it, but they didn't have any law really to work with. There were no laws that addressed that particular kind of criminal activity, and there were no punishments for them. So the police really had no way of approaching enforcement of that kind of, well, there was no law to enforce, so they just kind of dealt with it, and frankly, not very well. So bottom line is there was a lot of domestic abuse going on. Police were going in and were not really treating the situation very well many times because society, frankly, was very male-oriented, would simply not give an ear to what the women were saying, or most importantly, wouldn't understand what the women were saying because they just couldn't relate. So how did that change because of the Francine Hughes case? It didn't change case law because, you know, Francine Hughes was acquitted. She was found not guilty. If she had been found guilty and it then had been appealed, and then on appeal the case had been reversed, then there would have been some precedent in case law. It did, however, really set in motion, in Michigan for sure, the enactment of legislation, of laws that address the issue of domestic abuse. And those laws were first implemented within, I think, 2 to 3 years after the case. There was a representative by the name of Connie Binsfeld who sponsored those bills, and Governor William Milliken assigned them into law, and I had the pleasure of having him do that in a joint, I was standing up in front of a joint session of the state legislature, and he signed that into law, so I feel pretty good about that. Then, of course, subsequently, I believe every law, every state in the union has enacted laws like that.
The Francine Hughes story was turned into a book by Faith McNulty called The Burning Bed and a TV movie of the same title. We're going to hear a little bit of a scene from the movie where actor Richard Mazur, playing you, talks with Farrah Fawcett, starring as Francine Hughes.
Francine, in all my research, I haven't found a single precedent that would support a plea of self-defense. So this is what I recommend. Forget self-defense. And we change the plea to not guilty by reason of temporary insanity.
You mean crazy?
No, I mean that if I can get expert testimony as to your state of mind at the time of the murder, we may have a chance.
What did you make of the book and the movie? Were they accurate depictions of what actually happened?
The book was accurate in almost every sense, because Faith McNulty didn't, I mean, she wrote this book as a nonfiction, actual narration of what happened, and a lot of it is the result of interviews with me and even some interviews with Francine. And so I think it's accurate, and it's a good read because it's still, even though it's pretty much a narration of actual facts, she did a very good job of writing. The movie, on the other hand, I think did a real good job of being drama. I mean, it's a very dramatic movie and does a very good job of presenting the cruelty and the horror of that kind of a situation for Francine, as it would be for anybody. So a lot of people were impressed by it, and I heard a lot of people say they really thought it was terrific. But factually, as movies will do, it is not very accurate. And I was really disappointed to see this all occur in a geographical setting, which was supposed to be Michigan, but there were palm trees and mountains. I mean, we have mountains way up north, but, you know, there were palm trees and mountains, and they had filmed this in California. And then I had some input into the script, but movie producers and directors kind of do what they want to do. So I think it was a great movie. Up until recently, it was the best earning made for television movie ever. So good drama, not very accurate.
How much do we know about Francine Hughes and her life in the 40 years since the death of Mickey Hughes?
Not much. I know that some pictures were produced online by the Lansing State Journal, and there is one photo there of her and her children and her new husband, and I have heard things about their situation, but I can't really say anything about that because it may not be accurate. If I had some accurate information to give you about her, I would. I understand that just from what I have heard that she lived a middle-class, uneventful life in the South, I believe in Alabama, married to this gentleman by the name of Wilson. And I have not made any effort to contact her. I don't believe she wants to be contacted. I did get an email, curiously enough, from her son, Jimmy, who made contact with me and sounded like he might have wanted some contact with me, but I chose not to respond. I didn't think that was a good idea.
She has clearly shunned the spotlight, though.
She has.
And to some extent, someone who wants to shun the spotlight should be left alone.
Sure, because just like the current political situation, not everybody sees eye to eye, and certainly immediately after the Francine Hughes case, and I am sure even to this day, there are some people that feel very strongly about the rightness or wrongness of what she did and the fact that she wasn't really punished for that.
Arjen Greidanis represented Francine Hughes, the Dansville woman who killed her ex-husband Mickey Hughes in the famous burning bed case 40 years ago. She was found innocent by reason of temporary insanity. Arjen Greidanis, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.